This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, there's an old saying that I love. You know, if you've watched the show for any length of time, you've heard me say this, you've watched me say this on the show. The quote is this: do not quote laws to men with swords. That is, of course, not my quote, and I'm not saying I support such thinking, but it nevertheless was a quote from Pompey Magnus. He was a Roman who was at the time violating the law. And he was violating the law, and somebody came up to him and told him, "You're violating the law." And he had a bunch of dudes with swords around him, and he said, "Why are you telling me about the law? I'm here with a sword." We here in the United States of America are insanely blessed. And we don't fully appreciate it. I don't fully appreciate it. None of us will fully appreciate how blessed we have been to live in a country where we can lie to ourselves and say, well, we're a nation of laws. We're a nation of laws. Have you ever said that? Have you ever thought that? Do you think that now? We're a nation of laws. But see, that's not really true. That's never really been true of any nation. We are a nation, we have been a nation of good, decent people. The laws were downstream of that. And our society has been good and decent, not because of laws, but because the people themselves are good and decent. So what to do if you're a communist scumbag and you want to destroy the United States of America? Well, you have to find a way to get yourself a sword. And there is no better sword for a communist than the legal system itself. It's the most powerful entity, if you think about it, out there. The power over life and death, the power of freedom or to lock somebody in a cage. The legal system is the true sword in any society. And communists have always known this. You know, when they were rampaging through the Soviet Union, butchering all their political opponents, doing all manner of horrors, they didn't just do it on the streets. They put in their judges. When the Soviet Union did things like let murderers and rapists out of prison, they didn't just open up the prison gates and let them out. They opened up the prison gates and let them out, and then made sure they installed judges who would keep them out so they could continue to murder and rape and steal. None of that sounds familiar, right? Well, the communists have been doing this in the United States of America for years and years and years and years and years. We've seen this on the streets. We wake up, we look at cell phone video of animals butchering citizens, and we find out that person's been let out of jail 1,000 times. That's at the local level, usually, but all the way up now to the Supreme Court. The communist has installed his minions.
Your view of this turns on what the status of the parents are, and not the child, as would the born in the United States view of it. Can you help us understand why we wouldn't expect to see a mention of parents in the text of this amendment?
I think it was well understood that, for example, children cannot, you know, newborns cannot form domicile, so it followed every 19th century.
That assumes domicile is in the text, and I'm asking you, how do we know that Congress did adopt the test that you say it adopted.
Yeah, when you're looking at 19th century conceptions of allegiance, the notion that the allegiance, again, we say domicile is instantiating the concept of allegiance for aliens as opposed to citizen. All of that, the 19th century understands the newborn's domicile, its allegiance follows the allegiance of the parents. And I point out that their theory relies on parental allegiance as well, because they recognize the exceptions for, you know, hostile invading armies, for tribal Indians, for ambassadors. Again, the child's allegiance status, even on their view.
She's there as a warrior for the communist revolution. They got involved in the legal system. They've wormed their way through the legal system, and now we are being attacked by our own system. That is their sword. We'll talk to Jean Hamilton about that and other things next. You know why there's a men's clinic on every corner now? It wasn't like that 20 years ago, was it? Did you ever even see one of those things? Of course you didn't. Now they're everywhere. Why? Because testosterone levels are off a cliff in this country. Did you know that? We're losing 1% of our testosterone every single year. We've lost 50% in 50 years. Men are disappearing because we're drinking estrogen. There's estrogens in everything, in the plastics, in the water. It's freaking terrible. We have to reverse it, but we can't reverse it with needles jammed in our arm. We have to use natural herbal supplements to do that, and that's where Chalk comes in. A male vitality stack from Chalk will have your T levels jacked through the roof. You'll feel like $1 million energy. Your mind works good. Your mood is better. And this is all done with natural herbal supplements. Take a male vitality stack. Get a subscription. Chalk.com/JesseTV. One thing that has been extremely frustrating for people like me who want, you know, the mass deportation of people who are here illegally is how almost impossible it seems. It's not just almost impossible to deport them en masse. I mean, any one guy. It just seems like every time we try to get even one out of the country, our system is designed to keep them all here. At least that's how it seems from a stupid person. Let me ask Jean about it. Joining me now, Jean Hamilton, president of America First Legal. Okay, Jean, there are so many stories out there that we wake up and we look at our phone and we think, wait, what? We can't deport him. This judge ruled this. Is our system designed to keep all of them here?
Well, you would certainly think so if you follow the average story of any alien who gets picked up by ICE and is put into removal proceedings. What a lot of Americans don't understand at home is that illegal aliens who are put into immigration court, and not all of them have to be put in immigration court, but the ones who are get so many bites at the apple. They get a bite at the apple at the immigration court, but if they don't like the decision there, the immigration judge tells them to go home, they can appeal to the Board of Immigration Appeals. And then from there, if they don't like the decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals, they can file a petition with the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals that has jurisdiction over the state in which the immigration court is located. And if they don't like the decision there, then they can go to the Supreme Court. And then finally, if they don't like what the decision from the Supreme Court is, they can, at least historically, just kind of sit around and wait and hope that maybe someday people will just feel sorry for them and they'll give them some kind of an amnesty. They'll let them stay. They don't even have to comply with an order issued by a federal judge that tells them that it's time to go home. There's an old saying. I spent some years of my career working for ICE as an attorney, and there's an old saying amongst the ICE personnel that it's not over until the alien wins. And for a lot of the time in our history, that has certainly been the case. It is starting to change now under the Trump administration. Finally, it started to change in the first Trump administration, and I was there for all 4 years. I worked very closely on all of these issues. But it is certainly changing now. They're adjudicating more cases than what are actually coming in, and that's a result of a secure border, a tight border, fewer cases going into the pipeline, more judges actually issuing decisions that are consistent with the law. There are so many good things happening, but think about all the work that has to be done. to actually get this into a system that was designed to work, to be expeditious. Mind you, for everyone else at home, just one thing more to add here is that Bill Clinton signed into law 30 years ago in 1996 a provision called expedited removal. So it's a tool that was supposed to skip over the entire immigration court process for lots of different types of aliens. And for the longest time, the federal government didn't use it, or they didn't use it effectively. It's finally being used effectively now for at least the classes of aliens that qualify for it. But Jesse, the point being here is that Congress gave the government a lot of tools to be able to use. Is the system perfect as designed? No. But is significant progress being made today under the Trump administration that was using tools and resources that were just sitting there for years and for decades that people failed to do? Yes, actually, in fact, it is. So things are on the right trajectory. It seems like it can be impossible to get one guy and get him out of the country. But I think that we are getting over some of these radical activist judges. We're getting some lanes, some precedent established by the higher courts. And I think that the future is bright, at least for the ability to deport somebody. Now, whether we ever and always have an administration in the future that's willing to do it is an entirely different story. But the work that this administration is doing to ensure that any single alien who gets picked up by ICE for some reason or another is actually able to be physically removed the way that Congress intended has been nothing but short of amazing. I mean, just absolutely amazing what they've accomplished so far.
Okay. That's wonderful news. I'm worried the answer to my next question won't be, but I am curious hearing you talk about it. We obviously saw what the communists did for 4 years under Joe Biden and how they brought right. in as many as possible. We understand all those things. Is there anything we can do now? Because I'm assuming one day we're going to have a Democrat president again. That's how it goes. Is there anything we can do now that will stop them from being able to do that again? Because I believe they're going to do that again, if not worse. Can we do anything now that's essentially, for lack, pardon the pun, a wall that will stop yeah. them from doing it again?
Right. Jesse, look, I feel the same way that you do. History has shown us that past is prologue, and you have a Democratic Party these days that seems to be at the center of its policy platform as the highest of all of its priorities is advancing the needs and interests of illegal aliens. And so if they get back in power, I have no doubt that they're going to try to do things. One thing that can certainly be done is finish construction on the actual physical wall, which is very, very helpful to at least prevent people from coming in illegally. One of the things that is difficult, or is at least a little bit more difficult to be able to address, is stopping the next administration from telling the Border Patrol from just opening the gates and letting people in, which is something that Joe Biden did. There's a lot of footage of this happening during the Biden administration as well. Or even where you had barriers, you would see Border Patrol agents having to go out, open the gates, let the people in, and then process them in slowly. Now, Congress passed a law last year, the Laken Riley Act, that gives new authorities to states and to other people to be able to sue when the administration violates different provisions of the immigration laws. Obviously, no one's had to use those. No one's had to do anything with those new tools yet because of you have an administration that's actually willing to enforce the laws. So that's one thing. You can certainly, of course, construct an actual physical wall. There's a lot more reliance interests that I think the states are obtaining based on the enforcement of the laws by the current administration, that if another future administration were to stop or just to open the floodgates again, that they would have standing to sue a future administration and have it stopped in the future. The administration actually just entered into a consent decree or a settlement agreement, I think just recently in the last few months or within the last 6 months with the state of Florida about some of their border management policies, which of course means that anything that they try to do again in the future is gonna have to go back to a judge to get court approved before they can engage in it. So there's a lot of things that can be done, But ultimately, everyone at home knows that when people stay at home, when people sit out at the polls, whether it's for the midterms, whether it's presidential elections, whatever, and they're upset about one issue or they're upset about another issue, just know when you make that choice, you're making a conscious, deliberate choice that you know what they're going to do when the other side obtains power again. They're going to open the borders. They are going to let more people come into this country. And so if that's an important issue to you, that should be a motivating factor. But ultimately that's what our political process allows, is people to choose their person who's going to represent them in Congress or in the Senate, or who's going to serve as the president of the United States. And hopefully people do the right thing so that we don't have to deal with that horrible scenario that you just described.
Are we going to get a new attorney general, or are we going to just temporarily fix this thing?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's hard to say. Donald Trump, of course, is the person who knows what he wants to do here or what he's going to do, and he has every prerogative under the Constitution and laws of the United States to decide who is going to serve as his next attorney general. Now, Todd Blanche, serving as the deputy currently and as the acting attorney general, has the ability, with a few different laws that are on the books, to serve in perpetuity, quite frankly, as acting AG, assuming certain procedural mechanisms are used and enacted. But it is entirely feasible that he could serve as the acting attorney general for the rest of the term without needing to get confirmed into the final spot. I think preferably Donald Trump would select whomever the right person is in his mind, who's going to lead the Department of Justice, who's going to continue to enact his agenda and to deliver on the promises he made to the American people. And so hopefully that person gets a chance to go before the Senate and go for a full confirmation vote. But if that person doesn't, or if the Senate calendar just doesn't have enough days on the schedule, because of course they don't seem to work a lot these days, they're certainly, in the worst case scenario, Todd has the ability, at least the capability under law, to continue to serve the president as the acting for a long time.
Come back and see us soon. I actually feel better about some things. Appreciate you, man. All right. That monster who butchered that girl on that train in North Carolina. We're going to talk to Robert Guevara about that next. Nine hours. Do you know what it's like to sleep for 9 hours straight and then wake up, not groggy, wake up like, oh my gosh, I'm so rested. Wake up excited to start the day. That's what you can have every single morning with Dream Powder from Beam. You see, I understand there are all kinds of things out there that'll help you sleep. Every time you turn on the TV, there's something. You go to the doctor, there's something. But you don't need drugs. You need something natural. Look at all those natural things. Reishi, melatonin, magnesium. All those natural things. Well, a cup of hot chocolate before bed can give you all those things. Dream Powder from Beam is delicious. If you didn't know those things were in it, you would never know. You will sip on it, you will sleep like a baby, and you will wake up ready to go. You want a big discount? Go to shopbeam.com/Jesse Kelly. Get ready for the best sleep ever. Still wish I had not watched the unedited video of that. That's one of those things that stay with you. Joining me now, Robert Guevara, criminal defense lawyer, host of Watching the Watchers, which I would highly recommend. Robert, why do we have so many of these barbarians walking free in our society? The story's the same every day. We wake up, we grab our phones, we look, and some guy who's been arrested 8,000 times has butchered another innocent American, and yet they continue to walk free. Tell me, please. Make me understand.
Yeah, Jesse, thanks for having us. And it's a horrific story. And unfortunately, I think it's because a large part of our justice system has been perverted. We have judges and prosecutors and people who are supposed to be enforcing the law as neutral arbiters and stewards of the law have really turned into social justice warriors, and they are creating different systems that they think serve their preferred social endeavors. And that's essentially what happened here with this guy, as you mentioned. The guy's name is DeCarlos DeJuan Brown. There's reporting that he's had 14, maybe more, interactions with law enforcement and was released on the last interaction with law enforcement. He was again charged with a misdemeanor crime for calling 911 unnecessarily. He's got a history of prior robberies and burglaries and things with deadly, dangerous weapons. And the story is kind of the same. In fact, it's interesting because back during COVID, he was actually in custody. My understanding is that the NAACP, the ACLU, just to give you an idea of some of the people behind this social justice warriorism that we're seeing pervert the justice system, they were filing lawsuits saying, you know, COVID is an emergency and we have to get everybody out of custody. Jails are overcrowded. And there was a settlement agreement and he was on one of the lists and they just, you know, kind of let him out. Same story happens over and over again. There was another report that he had been on supervised release. Okay, so he's in jail for another crime before this horrific situation with murder of Arina Zarutska. And he was on basically parole. And of course, if you commit another crime while you're out on bail or out on parole or supervised release, you should go right back to prison, right? So you're kind of on extremely thin ice and you are not allowed to commit additional crimes while you're under supervision. But again, the reporting is that his parole officer or the supervisor just kind of put him back on supervised release status. And so it creates this cycle and this pattern where they get continual benefits after benefits and they're just released. And you know, a lot of this, I think, has to do with a lot of the same equity. We kind of hear equity used in various other contexts, but there's also this concept called bail equity. And we hear the term cashless bail. And the idea there is that some people who are arrested and charged with crimes, right? In America, we have a presumption of innocence, something that we endear and really appreciate. The government has the burden to prove that you're guilty. But a lot of the times we see it really gets perverted. You have a guy like this, 14 different interactions with the law, multiple criminal convictions, already many second, third, fourth, fifth chances. And we have these bail laws that say that if you're in custody again, they can't even hold you on bail. And the idea with bail is that you have to post a bond in order to get out of custody. So the thesis would be he gets charged again with this, you know, new misdemeanor crime for 911. In order to get out of custody, he's got to post a $500 or some small, you know, bond, typically speaking. But judges just are not, you know, doing that because they say that is not equitable, right? It's kind of giving rich people get out of free jail pass, while people who are less fortunate or don't have, you know, certain revenues to get out of custody are able to, or forced rather, to sit in jail pending the processing of their criminal case. So they have to sit in custody the entire time. So there are these laws then that eliminate cash bail. And the judges were just in this case asking this guy to reappear and just to come back to court on a promise to appear. And, you know, we're seeing this a lot in North Carolina where this horrific situation happened. They started to wake up a little bit. They passed Arena's law and they then are now, you know, kind of making the judges actually sit back and consider what they're doing before they release these people out on bond repeatedly or without bond, actually without any really security to make sure that they come back or to even just put a speed bump in the process to make the guy sit in custody. And unfortunately, what we see is he's released, he goes out, he stabs Arena, you know, three times in the neck. And then all of a sudden the case starts to process again. And we start to see other aspects of the criminal justice system now come to his benefit. In this case, of course, the competency proceedings, which are also now looking like they might be going, you know, his favor. And so it's, I think, this structural shift that has happened in recent times in criminal law. And I'm, you know, it's a formerly practicing criminal defense attorney. We spend a lot of time now doing Watching the Watchers, the show. But, you know, years ago, it was very difficult to get somebody out of custody when they, you know, they had a very violent history. You hear about these various laws like three strikes laws, and you have these multiple convictions, and it makes it harder to get out because there's this relationship which, you know, the more offenses you commit, the harder it is to actually get the benefit of the doubt in the justice system. And there's been this rapid shift after the George Floyd saga and after this kind of new social justice endeavor that a lot of various jurisdictions throughout the country are all bent on. And what we see, unfortunately, is, you know, innocent people are ultimately hurt at the end of it. And it's a really tragic situation that, unfortunately, in this case, you know, some of the reforms in North Carolina are just coming out too late.
Okay, can you walk me, as if I'm an idiot who doesn't understand it, because I am, in fact, both of those things. Can you walk me through the whole competency thing? Because everyone's reading these headlines and thinking, well, wait a minute. If this guy's such a friggin' barbarian that he's not even competent to control himself, but shouldn't he be locked away longer? Well, what? What?
Yeah, exactly. And competency is an important part of our justice system. It goes back to the Fifth and the Sixth Amendment. So we have, you know, due process of law. You have, under the Fifth Amendment, you have the right to a fair trial under the Sixth Amendment. And you really can't prosecute somebody if they're not mentally competent. It's not really due process if somebody is, you know, clinically insane or mentally ill to prosecute them for a crime, right? Same thing with the Sixth Amendment. You want your defendant to be able to assist their lawyer so that you get a fair trial, and it's not really a fair trial if you don't have the mental faculties to understand the facts and the circumstances and the severity of the crime that you've committed. And so it emanates from there. But like everything else we just talked about, these things are ripe for being perverted and for being exploited in many instances. And so what happened here in North Carolina is somebody had some suspicions that this guy may be mentally unwell. And so we started these competency proceedings to see if he actually knows what's going on and to get a sort of allegedly an objective overview of what is going on in his brain and whether he can understand the nature of the charges and the circumstances. And so the way it works is somebody will invoke it. In this case, I think the defense is very excited to have a decision like this because we'll explain what, you know, puts them on a different track in terms of prosecution. But judges can invoke it, prosecutors can invoke it, defense attorneys will often invoke it on behalf of their clients. And everybody has an interest in making sure that the person is actually competent, because if they're not competent and, you know, they're convicted, they're sentenced to go to prison, they appeal it, they say, I was not actually competent, it goes up to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals does a review and says, you guys didn't actually even do a competency determination at all. That means that the conviction can be reversed. And so all lawyers, judges, and everybody does not want the case to come back down after it's already been convicted, right? You don't want to have to do everything all over again. And so that process has started here, and it's been going on for quite some time. And when the murder happened, what ultimately happened is the competency proceeding started, and there was apparently an assessment that's done. Oftentimes, this is kind of a battle of the experts. You hear expert witnesses come in, and they'll have to evaluate the defendant. And you can often have different competing interpretations. So you might have one expert who says, this guy's competent, he knows what he's doing, and he's perfectly fit to stand trial. Whereas another expert might say, no, right, this guy's actually not well. And then in North Carolina, a lot of that decision-making is left up to the judge. And so we're not actually at the end game on this quite yet in this specific case. But what happened is DeCarlos Brown, he was sent over for an evaluation at a hospital there in North Carolina. They did a full assessment on him, and they sent that report back to the defense attorney. And the defense attorney then submitted that to the judge and said, Judge, this report came back, and it says he's not fit to stand trial. And part of the issue with this is, you know, our justice system is supposed to be accountable. We want to be able to have some transparency so that we can see exactly what is happening behind the scenes. That's why we have public record laws and open proceeding rules and various aspects of the process that, you know, we can peer into. When it comes to these competency proceedings, a lot of it happens, at least for the evaluations, happens behind closed doors. And so this guy and, you know, various people are all evaluating him. He's got HIPAA protections and privacy rights, and it happens, you know, essentially in secret. They'll write a report. The report will then be filed under seal with the court. And then from that process, what happens is the case, if the defendant is determined to be incompetent, you can have an incompetent but restorable situation. So you can pull him basically out of the criminal process. And you can think of it like a separate parallel track. So right now he's in the middle of a criminal prosecution. The report from his defense team, and it's now going up to the judge. The judge will ultimately, you know, weigh this in a full hearing. But what happens is at the moment, it's stayed, essentially. The case is stayed. And they're going to, at some point, make a determination over whether or not he can be restored to competency. So can he, you know, be put on medication? And it's not about competency at the time of the offense. That's more like an insanity defense. You didn't know what you were doing at the time of the crime. It's just whether you can be competent throughout the process of your criminal prosecution, such that when you're sitting in court, you know, yes, I'm being charged with murder. Yes, I know that there's a pretrial conference coming up, and you can be, you know, assistant to your own defense and your own defense team. But if you are restorable, if you can be put on medication or have some therapy and just kind of get back to this competent status, then they just put you right back into the criminal proceeding, which of course prosecutors and, you know, I think the victims of the case, Arena's family, would certainly want, so that the criminal prosecution can happen and he stays in criminal court where he'll be sentenced, you know, he'll have a trial or take a plea deal, and he'll ultimately serve the sentence for the crime that was committed. Now, if he's not restorable, so if he's incompetent now but not restorable, this is where things get very problematic for the victims and for prosecutors, because you can't prosecute somebody who's mentally incompetent. And so it really would take them out of the criminal prosecution track completely and put them in over into a civil involuntary commitment type of proceeding. And then you would just say that this person is basically permanently incompetent and they really can't answer for their crimes because of this incompetency. And that whole process is very different than the criminal process. Now you're talking about involuntary committal at a psychiatric institution, which is obviously a lot different than a, you know, prison. And people are asking about that because you can't really validate. Where, you know, a lot of people, a lot of defendants want to pretend that they're incompetent. And in this case, you don't really know what was asked or answered at all. And we all saw the video where he seemed pretty competent. It seemed like he knew exactly what his intention was. He, you know, sliced her neck multiple times, got up, was walking around saying, "I got that white girl, I got that white girl." And, you know, from then, people say, well, he's already been through the criminal justice process multiple times. We've seen him here, you know, 14 different interactions, multiple other criminal charges. So it feels very convenient that when you're in the middle of this murder of, you know, "I got that white girl" situation, that suddenly he's incompetent and he may be put on a track that deviates him from actual, you know, the criminal justice system and puts him on this civil track. Now, all that being said, the DOJ, he also has parallel cases that are happening right now. So the Department of Justice has also charged him at the federal level. And in that case, it was involving, he was on a light rail, so the blue line there in North Carolina. And he had, of course, riding public transit. The public transit system has federal funding. And so they charged him at the federal level as well with a death on a mass transit system. And the DOJ just today came out and they said, hey, you know, don't get too worried about this, about deviating him off the criminal path into the civil commitment path, because we're going to do our own evaluation. It's a whole separate parallel process. So, you know, the competency proceedings will happen again in front of a federal judge, and there are federal experts, you know, that they will rely on. And so he'll have really two evaluations on that. But as it progresses right now, he's actually in federal custody. So the state is kind of stalled out in general until the feds decide, you know, what the next step is and are able to come to their own determinant about whether he has the faculties to actually sit through this prosecution.
Okay, another dumb question. Sorry, you're just going to have to get used to these. So if, let's say, the state says he's just a nutter, we're sending him to the nut house. Can the feds then step in and say, no, he's not, we're going to try him in federal court? Can that happen? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what the DOJ was trying to reassure us about today, is that there will be a much broader review at the federal level that involves a federal judge, involves federal experts, and they've got priority and precedent on the case right now. So the state is also stalled out, just procedurally speaking, because they're also, you know, processing it. And the idea is, if you have even competing results, let's say the state says he's incompetent and not restorable, so he cannot be put back in to the state system, the feds could come to a different determination saying he's competent, maybe, but restorable. And so, you know, it's not going to be, the end game would be at the federal level that he ends up in a psychiatric institution. It would be that he could actually, you know, be prosecuted all the way through a trial or a plea deal and be sentenced appropriately, and then just serve his time in a federal penitentiary versus, you know, the state having to, you know, kind of deviate him out of the criminal path.
Okay, Now, let's switch to something that I consider to be very good news. Hannah Dugan, what did she do and where's she headed right now?
Yeah, this is the backdoor judge, Hannah Dugan. She let an illegal alien have his way with her back door and just use it however he wanted. It was a wild situation. She went all the way up through a trial and was ultimately convicted of really two counts. One was obstruction and one was interference, I think concealing a person who is wanted under a federal warrant. And this case is a wild one because this is a judge, right? Speaking back to these social justice warrior judges and these prosecutors who exist in our judicial system, she was in the middle of a criminal proceeding. There was an illegal alien called Eduardo who had been charged with multiple assault charges for, you know, beating other people, victims, who were in the very courtroom that Hannah Dugan, the judge, was presiding over. And ICE agents showed up. This was earlier in Trump's administration last year. They were, you know, going to courthouses to arrest these, you know, violent offenders. And when they showed up, Judge Hannah Dugan, in the middle of the court proceeding, somebody alerted her that ICE was in the courthouse. And she actually got off the bench. She was in her judicial robe. She left, went into another judge's chambers, got another judge, also said, keep your robe on, right? We're gonna do all of this under the color of our judicial authority. And they went out in front of the courtroom. So they left her courtroom, went out. There were like six, maybe ICE agents who were standing outside, and they obstructed them. She went to them. She said, hey, you know, what, do you have a warrant here? You need a judicial warrant? They said, no, we don't. We have an administrative warrant. We're allowed to arrest this guy. And she basically removed them, at least two of them, from the front of her courtroom so that they were not there, you know, monitoring the door. Took them down to the judge's chambers and was basically enabling the chief judge to get on a phone call with them and buying this guy time. Now, there were other ICE agents who were also in the hallways. They didn't all go with her. And what happened is she went back into the courtroom. It's reprehensible as an attorney to think about this going down for either side, but they went back into the courtroom and she called the case immediately. So she comes in, she calls Eduardo's case instantly. She basically leaps frogs in front of all the other attorneys in the courtroom. She calls it off the record so that she doesn't actually announce it in front of the rest of the courtroom. It's an open proceeding, and continued the case. So she just bumped it, let's say another 30 days or so. She didn't talk to the prosecutor. The prosecutor's there, right? The state has a say. This guy is allegedly, he was arrested for, you know, beating people. Prosecutor didn't have any say in what happened. The victims were in the courtroom there because they have a right to know. There's victim rights laws that exist on the books, so victims are not left out to dry. And no one knew about anything. So she continued the case. She's on the record as saying, you know, I'm gonna take the heat for this and more. But she ultimately then let this illegal alien Eduardo and his lawyer exit out the back door of the courtroom. That's why we call her Backdoor Dugan, because she escaped them out this non-public hall, which is for judges and attorneys. When they go back into judges' chambers, they'll bring jurors in and out of this back door. And she escaped him out the back. And then he ultimately kind of went down a level and then emerged back in the hallways. And these other ICE agents were there. They saw him, they, you know, traced him down, and he ultimately ended up fleeing outside the courthouse. They had to run him down, tackle him, and bring him back into custody. So we had a full trial. It was pretty damning, actually. A lot of the other judges and a lot of the clerks, like a lot of this was actually being recorded. And she was just flagrant misbehavior from this judge. And then she gets caught, they go to trial, she gets convicted, and she just this week lost her motion for a judgment for acquittal. Basically, her argument was she had judicial immunity, all of this with it was within the purview of her judicial power, and she was allowed to handle the proceedings as she saw fit. And the federal judge, so she's a state level judge, so this all was taking place in federal court. She made this argument that the trial judge made all these mistakes about admitting evidence, not admitting evidence, not considering her judicial immunity. So, you know, she can essentially, her argument was, commit crimes and violate victims' rights, violate, do things ex parte, which means, you know, not communicating with the prosecutor in the case, and obstruct federal agents. It was all part of her job. And the federal judge came down this week and said, your motion for a judgment for acquittal is denied. Both of those charges will stand. And so the case will move forward for a sentencing proceeding. And ultimately, we'll see what happens there when the judge gets the opportunity to sentence her. But it's an insane thing to think about, right? The judge who's supposed to be the purveyor of the law, the neutral arbiter who's just executing the law, was actively, maliciously, with sheer clear intent, trying to, you know, obstruct and interfere with federal agents who had a valid administrative warrant. It's happening, unfortunately, in you know, more and more locations.
All right, I have to ask about the 2020 election. No, I'm not going to let it go, but I was told repeatedly that it was, what did they say? The freest and fairest election ever and the most secure election in history. Over and over and over again, I was told that, which, of course, that's what made me most suspicious. Anyway, Rob, was it?
I don't think so, and we're seeing a lot of additional investigations that are now getting under steam, a lot of momentum here. We've had the seizure of the ballots in Fulton County, which is where we had the water main break at State Farm Arena, right in the middle of the count. They seized hundreds of thousands of ballots from that one particular county under a valid search warrant. We're having a big battle over that right now about whether they have to return those ballots, but that one's heating up. We have a case in California where the sheriff there, Chad Bianco, noticed a big problem. They had a discrepancy in the votes of the last Prop 50 election that just took place last year for the California redistricting vote. And what they found is that 45,000 votes, almost 50,000 votes emerged out of nowhere. There was a digital reporting of the numbers, and there was a physical counting of the ballots, and then the poll workers signed these logs. They would say, okay, we counted 1,000 in this stack, and they'd physically write on a document, you know, 1,000 ballots. Well, another third-party group called REIT actually went and counted all of the logs, and they said, well, your physical reporting doesn't match the digital reporting that the machine spit out. So they went and seized about 650,000 ballots over there. And that was unfortunately yesterday just paused by the California Supreme Court. So Sheriff Chad Bianco, who's also running for governor there, he was ordered to stop recounting, to stop his criminal investigation. But we'll ultimately see that was ordered to be sent over to a special master. And the special master presumably will help facilitate a resolution there. But in California, they seem very nervous. They're, you know, panicking, essentially. The attorney general there was demanding that he stop the count. And not a recount of the election, just a count of the ballots, just to validate whether the digital reported number was accurate or whether the actual physical ballot number was accurate. And so that one's also underway. And I think a big one also is developing out of Arizona. So we know that the FBI and the DOJ sent a subpoena to the Senate president in Arizona related to the 2020 elections and demanded essentially via a valid grand jury subpoena to have those records delivered over. And that would include the entire Arizona voter registration database, which I think is really the critical piece of evidence because you can validate who's on the list, right? Whoever controls the list is kind of going to win the election. And there was just yesterday a criminal referral because the attorney general and the Arizona Secretary of State, Chris Mays and Adrian Fontes, soon as they got wind of that subpoena and the Arizona Senate sent all the records over to the FBI, they had a meltdown. Chris Mays, the attorney general, sent letters to every single county recorder in the state of Arizona, basically threatening them with class 6 felonies and multiple criminal charges if they turned over any more information. And so the Arizona Senate president has now said that's a crime. He went and got a big, beautiful memo from a local Arizona law firm validating the fact that this is obstruction by the Arizona Secretary of State, by the Arizona Attorney General. They can't threaten the county recorders to not comply with a federal grand jury subpoena. We've got a supremacy clause. The grand jury subpoena takes precedent over any of their privacy concerns. And so he just sent a criminal referral in against both of them into the Arizona district attorney, the U.S. attorney there for the DOJ. And so we're keeping our eye on all of these things, but they are now, you know, really digging into the evidence. And this is the first time we've ever actually seen it. To your point, there was a whole slew of people saying after 2020, no court of law ever found anything. And it's the answer is, of course, they investigated themselves. The people who rigged the elections investigated themselves, found they did nothing wrong. And so now we're seeing evidence and actual investigations happen in multiple states. And so we'll keep our eye on it to see what comes of it.
Robert, stay on it, my man. I appreciate you very much. All right. We have final thoughts. I like companies that support veterans and hire Americans. It really comes down to that. Maybe I should come up with a list. These are the companies that support veterans and hire Americans. While the big cell phone companies are out there sending your money to Planned Parenthood and Black Lives Matter, Pure Talk's out there supporting veterans. And while the big cell phone companies are out there hiring every foreigner they can get their hands on, Pure Talk's hiring Americans. I can't give a company a higher compliment. They're on the same tower, so I'm not asking you to sacrifice cell phone service. You can keep your phone and keep your phone number if you're worried about this being some sort of a big pain or an inconvenience. It's nothing at all. Switch to Pure Talk and patronize the company that shares your values, promotes your values, cares for veterans, run by a Vietnam veteran. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV and switch today. It's fast, it's easy, you'll feel good about it. We have to clean out our judicial system, our legal system in this country. We can't ever fully stop the communist revolution until we root that out. Now, that's going to take some time. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, but we do have to set our sights on that, and we will. We'll do it again.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
About something about a comedic tone.
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.